welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we've got Bridget Mayer joining us. Bridget owns an art gallery in Pennsylvania, and she is the author of a new book, The Art Cure, a memoir of abuse and fortune. She recently published it in September, and it is available at Amazon. You can check her out and purchase her book there. This episode really blew me away. Bridget spent decades of her life cultivating her passion for art, artists, clients, and she advises people all over the world on art. But it didn't start like that. Her childhood started in a very abusive environment. It landed her in foster care homes and on the street, starving, actually getting her food from dumpsters out of a window that she had to climb out because her mother had locked her into a one-bedroom apartment with her five siblings. She wasn't even able to actually go to school. Eventually, she was placed in an adopted family, and she began her life at age 9, going to an incredible college, pulling herself out of this devastating childhood into a multi-million dollar art gallery business. What was really exciting about our interview wasn't just the story, which blew me away, but her dedication and commitment to an authentic life. She really wanted success. She's hardworking. She believed in herself, but she trusted her gut instinct and followed it despite fear, despite obstacles, despite the art world, which is one of the hardest places to earn a living. I know you're going to love this episode. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Again, if you'd like more information, check her out at Bridget Mayer, MAYER.com, and you can find her book, The Art Cure, A Memoir of Abuse and Fortune, at Amazon.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions, comments, anything you want to tell us about the show, you can send me a note at Laura@LauraCoe.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. Today we have Bridget Mayer joining us. Hey, Bridget, how are you today?
Hey, Laura, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited for our conversation today. We were chatting for just a couple minutes. We've just met, but Bridget was sharing her love of the concept of authenticity, so I'm really excited. Yes. But before we jump into authenticity and building a life of meaning, I am just so struck by your story, how you've gotten to where you are. You run an art gallery, you've got a new book out, but it didn't start this way. It started off pretty difficult. Could you take the listeners through, you know, your childhood, how you started off in the world, how you came to the art world, and just sort of start from the beginning a bit?
Sure. Yeah. And this is really actually how I start my book, which is called The Art Cure, A Memoir of Abuse and Fortune. And it's part memoir about my life and my difficult beginnings and then how I did get into the art world. And I was really compelled to want to share my story for many reasons. One really was to help artists and creative people, giving one example of a possibility on how to make it in the art world. I was born in a tenement building in Jersey City, New Jersey. My mother, my birth mother, was a drug addict, alcoholic. I had five other siblings, never knew my father. And basically, she would leave us for days or weeks sometimes without food and care. And then if she was around, it was a very volatile and abusive situation. We were hospitalized a few times from her abuse, and it was really a very scary, strange environment to be born into.
Were you the oldest of five? That's a lot of siblings to...
I know. I was in the middle of the group. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's incredible. So your life as a child was really just truly, we talk about this so much in the self-help world where people feel they're in flight all the time and right, there's the proverbial bear in the bush, but you were really dealing with day-to-day survival, trying to find food, trying to just get through the next day.
Exactly. And it was survival. And so at a very young age, I started learning how to protect myself and how to survive. I mean, there were times we had to climb out the building window to actually go get food because we would be locked in the apartment. So we had to trash pick and beg for food and even steal food to really stay alive.
Why were you locked in the apartment? Was it locked from the outside?
Yeah, she had, I don't even know how she did it, but we would just be locked in so that we wouldn't leave because she would go off on a drug or alcohol binge for, you know, the sense of time for me back then was very strange. It would seem like days. And, you know, literally our fridge was empty. We didn't have any furniture in this apartment. There was a bed and a couch and a radio and I think two chairs in the kitchen. My siblings and I slept in one bed together. It was a queen size mattress on the floor. We had one set of clothing that was on our back. We didn't grow up with toys and some of the normal things that kids have, things to play with and be occupied with, or, you know, TVs, and now it's technology. So literally it was a bare, dirty apartment.
And what would you guys do during the days when she's gone and you're locked in this apartment?
Well, I talk about this in the book because that's really where I started tapping into my inner creativity. I really would be very comfortable being quiet and alone in my mind. And I would do things like one day I found a tray of ice cubes in the freezer. It was literally the only thing in that freezer. And I invented a game with dropping ice cubes out the window. So another time I did find a vacuum cleaner in one of the closets and dragged that out. And of course, within a few minutes, broke the vacuum cleaner, which later got me in pretty big trouble. And that's another story in the book. And really one of the turning points for me in my story and connecting to art and creativity was finding a bag of makeup that my mom had left in the bathroom. And I didn't know what it was. And I was kind of in shock with these materials and colors. And I remember taking the makeup over to a wall and just starting to create, just smearing it everywhere and feeling a sense of liberation and joy and actually having something to play with and making something. So that story is in the book. And that was really the first moment where I had access to a material that was artistic and colorful, and it really opened my mind up to another world.
And all of this was before the age of nine.
This was all before the age of nine and before I was adopted.
That's amazing. And what were your other siblings doing? I mean, were you guys interacting? Was it mainly quiet in the house? Like, were certain
siblings? It was siblings pretty quiet. Yeah, it was pretty quiet. We were interacting a little bit, and I think I was kind of the troublemaker with, like, let's throw ice cubes out the window, let's ride on this vacuum cleaner, let me smear the makeup on the wall, and just finding stuff to create with. And I had older siblings that on occasion my mom would take with her to the bar she was going to or wherever she was at to take care of her. And so it was always a little bit confusing in this apartment.
Where was this? What city was this in?
So Jersey City, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Which is nearby, close to Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. And so, so you're enduring this childhood where, you know, a little bit of makeup and a vacuum is really all you have to express yourself. And it's interesting to hear you say that that's a troublemaker, right? Like for most of us. It's like a day in the life of a kid is just like ripping through cabinets. And I just had my friend's 18-month-old and he just tore apart all my Tupperware and threw it everywhere. And, and you know, it's like such a part of childhood to just claw your way through things.
I love that about children. Yeah.
But you're saying this was like you're the rebellious one doing this. So it must have been on such lockdown in that house.
Oh, it was. I mean, when my mom would come home, it was okay, everyone be quiet. And we would huddle in this room. And it was like this presence in the space. And, you know, if we made noise, we actually would get beat with a broomstick. So it was, it was intense. It was really intense.
So how did this come to an end? Did somebody complain? Like, how did you eventually get removed from this? A prison?
It was. And there's something in New Jersey called the Division of Youth and Family Services. And one of our neighbors brought to their attention the fact that we were abandoned and living in this apartment by ourselves with no parents. And They showed up to get us out of there. And basically, really from the time I was a baby until I left permanently, I was in and out of foster care. We'd go into a foster home for a few weeks. I'd be separated from my siblings, and then we'd be brought back to my birth mother, and she'd clean herself a week or two, and then we would go back into foster care. And
oh, interesting. So during that first 9 years, the state was involved, and you were back and forth.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were back and forth quite a bit, and then there were a few episodes where she beat us so badly that some of us ended up in the emergency room, and that's where things intensified, and the state got more involved and basically started looking for a more permanent home for us. And one of the incidences happened on a Thursday night, and they don't hold kids in their office or through the weekend because they all go home and they don't work over the weekend. So they literally had one day to find foster homes for all of us. And typically they have a net, they have a database where people register to be foster parents, and they'll try to find a place as close to the current residence as possible. And finding something on a Thursday night or Friday morning to have kids placed by Friday night was really challenging. So they kept widening the net and eventually widen it a few hours away, which is unusual for them to do, to another county. Mm-hmm. And in that county was a woman who had registered her name and wanted to foster young girls. And so they called her basically and said, "Hey, we have two little girls who need a home by tonight. Will you take them?" So that's how I got placed into that home that eventually became the home that adopted me.
Oh my God. I'm sure everybody listening, I have goosebumps. What a story. I mean, were you elated when you would get into these other homes? Was it just all overwhelming the entire time? I mean, was there any sense of reprieve when you would be removed, or?
We were back and forth so much that I kind of was a little bit numb to the process.
Yeah.
And just really nervous and fearful. So I literally would be locked inside my brain and body and just on lockdown, just trying not to make noise, trying not to get in trouble, not to look up. And it didn't really mean anything to me at that time yet, the significance of being brought several hours away into a beautiful farm area with a great family. I didn't know what I was stepping into yet at the time.
Unbelievable. I feel like this could be made into a movie. So you go from there to literally like transforming your entire life, ending up running a multi-million dollar business. So how do you go from this scared child who's locked into their body and soul, and I'm sure disassociated and everything that goes along with trauma, to what is such a high functioning person sitting here today? What were the first steps to begin to heal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really my healing started when I was brought into the home of the Mayer family, my adopted family. They lived in a beautiful part of Hunterdon County. They had a beautiful farm with pets and animals and a vegetable garden. And my dad's hobby was farming, and he was actually worked in Newark, New Jersey, but for AT&T at the time. And really it started from having safety and security, a bed, a roof over my head, three meals a day and water to drink, clothing, a shower. And that was the first time I started to actually experience a normal, quote, normal life. And at that point, I hadn't been to school yet, so I didn't know how to read. And I really had to my mom had to catch me up with reading and learning and trying to catch up to my age group. So
you hadn't been to school at all? You guys?
No.
Oh my God. So when you say you were sitting in this apartment, I mean, literally.
Yeah. Yeah. That was on purpose. My birth mother didn't want people to, she didn't want to register us with the school, didn't want people looking for us or trying to find us. So we weren't in any school system.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. So, but I remember I was really excited by, I knew it was really important that I figure out how to read and learn. And I actually really liked the challenge of it. And I was tutored for a whole summer to catch up with my grade. And that's really where it started, just like diving in and learning and trying to catch up with my age group. And, you know, as I got older, my goal was really to go to college and excel in sports and to be in college and graduate from a great college. And I started working and getting jobs when I was young, and I'm a worker. I love working. I love learning. I love being around people. So those were things that started me on my path.
And I mean, I'm sorry, but to just back up, like at what point in this process did you start to realize it's over, I'm safe, the food's not going to go away? You know what I mean? Like all these basic survival needs are met, and then you can start to thrive. I wanted to go to college, right? Was it a slow transition or was it?
We were taken out of the foster home we were in twice and sent back to our birth mother. And that was incredibly traumatic for me because I had bonded with my adopted mother, and I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt safe, I felt alive, I felt secure. And to be in that environment and then to have someone come pick you up and literally bring me back to the environment I was living in was a nightmare. And it was really traumatic for me. And after the second time, it was also traumatic for my adopted mom because she was really attached to us and she knew what we were going through. And so I tell this story in the book. That's when she realized that if she wanted to help us, that she was going to have to fight and really work with the state to work to adopt us. And she was ready to do that and take it to Washington if she had to. And so she really started the fight to adopt us at that point.
Oh, what an incredible woman.
Yeah, she's amazing. And the rules were pretty stringent with keeping kids with their birth families, despite what was very obvious to everyone, which was that we were being abused and neglected. And they didn't really care. They just put us back in the environment and followed the rules.
Yeah, no, unbelievable. Yeah. The foster care system we have is, you know, to say the least, broken. So,
yeah.
So you go to college, you create this incredible life for yourself, and you decide I'm gonna become an artist. One of the hardest ways to make a living.
Yeah.
But for you, I would think there's a bit of confidence that you know how to survive most situations. Did that play into your confidence in trying to build a life in an area that a lot of people find so difficult to monetize?
I don't think it was confidence as much as at the time it wasn't really confidence yet. It was more, what do I love to do? Like, what makes me happy? And this started for me with that makeup story. And then it kept going, you know, living on this farm I was growing up on and, you know, making things and playing in the fields and, you know, being around animals and, you know, being creative and painting. And then in high school, I loved my high school art classes. And I always gravitated into that realm. And for me, it was a place that I could fully express myself. There was no right or wrong in making art. It was just all about being. And so that followed me to college. And I went to a really great college that was not an art school. It was an engineering business school called Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. And I think my parents hoped that I would be, you know, biology or an English major. And I knew that I wanted to study art. And so it kind of dragged out with them. And I decided, you know, hey guys, I'm really going to do this. I want to study art history and studio art. And that's what I'm going to do.
And so you had that wherewithal, despite, you know, so many people would make the argument that that level of trauma in your life, like you can't embody your authentic self and you can't find who you really are. And here you are just able to, at such a young age, own what you love and follow that passion. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was working I had to get a job to pay for books and some of my tuition and some other stuff at college. So I got two jobs in college, and I was also on the track team. I was an athlete too. And I worked at the gallery at Bucknell University, and I fell in love with the job. I just loved the gallery work. And I was also doing publicity work for the theater department. And part of that was creating posters and window displays. And I really loved that work too. And so I knew that I was on the right path, because I was doing things in college that I loved, and I was getting paid to do them. And so that just kept propelling me forward.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. So how does that bridge over to you eventually having your own gallery?
That's a great question. I graduated, I went overseas, and you know, my whole interim between college and opening up my gallery business, I was working in creative jobs and basically would learn as much as I could, spend as much time as I felt necessary. And then when I felt that I was at the end, I would jump out and get into my next creative job. And I kept doing that. And one of my challenges with working in the gallery world was that it doesn't pay well. I was living in New York City right after college, working in a really great gallery in Soho at the time before everyone migrated to Chelsea. And I literally was making, after taxes, it was around 10 bucks an hour. And I spent the first part of my job year commuting from New York City back to Hunterdon County. And I'd leave at 6 a.m. and get home at 8:30 at night, so I could live with my parents and not have to take on an apartment. And I was saving money. And eventually I moved to New York and moved into basically a closet space with a roommate, and really just kept struggling. And I realized, oh my gosh, to even do normal things like go to the gym or go out to dinner with people, I'm going to have to get a second job. And that continued in all the gallery jobs I was working in. And I started getting incredibly frustrated because I loved the work. I loved the sales work that I was doing. I loved working with artists and clients, but I kept saying, like, gosh, how are people making money in the art world? And that's when things started to shift for me. I started looking at the art world more expansively. And what I could see pretty clearly was that it was the art gallery owners and the somewhat well-known or famous artists that were making all the money. And so I was like, I have two options here. I can either be a business owner, or I could be a very well-known artist, and that's how I'm going to make my money. And I knew deep down inside that sitting in a studio by myself for hours on end making art was not really what I wanted to do. I could do it, but that wasn't where my passion was. So I started my own art consulting business out of my apartment. I started selling art and working on corporate projects and working with artists professionally, coaching them to build up their resumes and what they needed to get to the next level. And pretty quickly that led to me deciding to open up a physical gallery space, because what I really loved about the gallery world was the ability to have the public come in and to educate them about exhibitions and an artist. And I love the connective educational component with that experience. So that's what really led me to do that.
Unbelievable. I have a question I've been dying to ask you. I didn't know when to insert it, but I'm just going to. Having gone through a childhood like that and then, you know, going from there all the way to a business owner, and you're mentioning all these situations where, you know, working from 8 a.m. till 6 o'clock at night, and then I have to get a second job. But do you ever find anything to be like that difficult? Like when people are complaining around you and, oh, I'm so tired and I'm so this and, you know, all these quote unquote first world problems. do you have that? Or is that just like from your upbringing, that's just not part of your mindset?
No, I have it. You know,
like, do you get tired, or are you just like, no, it's nothing? Like everything's relative.
No, I get tired. I get frustrated. I get angry. I've gone through a lot of changes in my life and my business. And I've definitely, you know, the thing that I really struggled with that I had to get through was this feeling of fear in my life. And, You know, fear has been a huge factor from my childhood, even, you know, it shows up now still. And I remember one day I literally was sitting at my desk and I was a year into my business and I felt all this anxiety. And I was like, what's going on with me? My hands were like shaking. And I realized like, I'm terrified of failing. And I didn't want to look back. I didn't want anyone that thought I was going to be a starving artist to be right. I wanted to stake my claim in the art world. And so, you know, fear has been something that I've had to overcome at many stages of my life. I talk about this in the book. Like there's a point where one of my big challenges early on in my business was I didn't realize how much in the public realm I would be by having such a public business. I didn't really think about that part of it. And
right.
Getting asked to do public speaking and be on panels and do museum tours and things that gallery owners do. And I kept saying no. I would make up an excuse or just say, I can't do it. It doesn't work with my schedule. And I realized I was terrified of public speaking and that if I didn't do something about it, it could potentially hamper my career. So
what did you do about that?
Well, so I remember this day I was sitting there and I said no to speaking at, I think it was University of Pennsylvania on a panel at the museum there. And I was like, kind of like almost in tears, like so mad at myself. And like, you know, I'm acting like this person that's shrinking in my career and when I want to be doing the opposite. And so I just remember saying, okay, that's it. I have to take a stand. The next 10 things that I get asked to do, I'm going to say yes.
And I love that.
Yeah. And then I'm like, okay, I need to talk to someone that's a public speaker and find out what I can do to actually start practicing and working on this. And literally the next day, this is no joke, I got a call from CNN, from a producer at CNN. They had seen an article that was written about me in a magazine and they loved the story. And Anderson Cooper wanted to profile me for a program he was doing called On the Rise. And they were looking at different industries and younger business owners that were on the rise. And they researched me and they felt that I was on the rise. So I was like, are you kidding me? Like the first call I get is for CNN. And
oh my God, you gotta be kidding me.
It's No. And yeah, within 2 weeks, the 10 things that I said I would say yes to were on my calendar.
Oh my God. I mean, come on, but CNN first?
Yeah.
I saw that you were on CNN, but I figured that was like later.
No, I thought it was a joke. I actually hung up on the person. They said, no, this is so really? And no, don't hang up.
Unbelievable. So, you know, this stuff about putting stuff out in the universe and it comes back and all that, it's like, you know, there's these moments where you're like, there's something to this.
Yeah, there is. I believe in it. As a matter of fact, I was just posting on Facebook this morning. I do a lot of art consulting. And about 5 years ago, wrote down one of my goals was to do international art consulting. And literally in the last 3 years, I've been doing consulting around the world. And, you know, I have to ask, if I hadn't written that down, would I be attracting and doing this art consulting around the world? So I believe in it, the law of attraction.
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, this whole idea that opportunity meets preparedness, I think there's so many options in front of us all the time. Our minds can only take in a fraction of what we're exposed to. We just are only conscious of such a small amount. And so when you set the intention for things, you realize, that reality is available to me as well. I don't believe in sitting in your house and waiting for things. I think that's the problem with some of that new age stuff is like, if I just believe in it, it'll come. It's like, no, get two jobs, work your
You have to be out there actually working.
Hard and smart and meeting and asking for help and reaching out to people and all that stuff has to happen as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fascinating. So here you are, you're set this intention. Suddenly you're finding yourself on CNN of all places with Anderson Cooper. I love his interviews. Were you able to get past the fear? Like this is something that comes up for entrepreneurs all the time, facing fear. Facing these challenges, not giving up, not caving. How did you get yourself through it? Just medicated or?
No, I know, right? It's funny because I I thought of, I'm like, maybe I'll just have a shot of whiskey or just, but no, I just did like a crash course. I read a book called Face Your Fear and Do It Anyway, or maybe it was called Feel Your Fear and Do It Anyway.
Yeah, I think I've heard of that one.
I talked to a therapist who specialized in working with actors to get them to relax before performance. And so I started getting some coaching around that and just, because what would happen is I would literally stop breathing and almost have a panic attack and pass out. And I was worried about doing that.
And you're going on CNN.
And I didn't want to tell them how terrified I was because I knew the opportunity would be really important and I didn't want to have them not come out. So I realized I had to learn how to relax and breathe. And then I started going to Toastmaster meetings and I went to a few a week. They're all over the city of Philadelphia. And I found a few locations and started going to multiple meetings a week and practicing. And I just kept practicing speaking. And then I just realized a big part of it was just mental and being relaxed and breathing and being present with the person and not being in the space of the unknown. But it was a lot to overcome for me. And
that's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. And I mean, fear of speaking is up there in the top five fears. I mean, people really, I think it's because when we're kids, they force us to do these horrible reports on a book in front of our friends. And you're like, Columbus came to America. Like all your friends are like giggling and the teacher's like, wrong, wrong, wrong. You know, and it's like when you get older, the only reason you're asked to speak is because you're the expert. You know, and so it's literally inverse to what we're trained as kids. Like you're sitting there being judged and graded versus when we go to hear somebody speak it, we really are passionate about what they have to say.
Oh, yeah. And I had to undo years of being, you know, if I would speak up, I would get beat. So I literally, it was a condition that don't speak up or else you're going to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I realized, no, if I don't speak up, I might not be as successful as I would like to be. And for me, I felt a responsibility to really, it was for my artists that I was representing in my business to make sure that I was doing the most I could as the business owner and as their agent to promote them. And if I wasn't working on the things that were scaring me, then I wouldn't be doing my job properly for them. So that was part of it.
So during this conversation, the thing that I feel like keeps coming up, and we talked about it for just a minute before we hopped on this call, but this idea that you get to various points and you recognize this isn't what I want and I'm going down this other path. And although that path is unknown and it's the art world or it's public speaking, I'm going to overcome. And although I have to take another job, I'll take another job. And you've set up your whole life. And when I read your bio, one sentence really stood out for me. In that you have expertise encompassing a whole approach to art collecting, creating authentic environments, both public and private, in art. And so this idea of being truthful to yourself, you spoke about it before we were talking, that authenticity is such a core value for you. Where do you believe this came from? Why is this such an important thing? The idea of this show, of course, is having success, but success with meaning. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how this idea of staying true to yourself and living an authentic life and why you actually put the actual word in your bio, what this means to you and your experience?
Sure. Well, I know where it came from because there was a moment when I was younger where I remember saying to myself, this is not right. This is not my life. This is not going to be my life. And I knew with great sensitivity that what was happening to me was not only right, but that I knew I didn't want it. And so
you're talking about in your childhood.
Oh yeah. And you know, that kind of ability to have an inner sensitivity of how things felt and how things feel to me. And I do this now with everything. Like, does this feel right? Does this feel good? Is this something I want to do? And going back to that, because we live in a world where everything is moving so quickly and everyone is, you know, communicating online and there's a lot of messages and people are pushing people to do this or don't do that. And growing up with, you know, being a young kid, I was pushed and pulled and as young kids are. And so I would always come back to what felt right to me and what I wanted. And
But I love this question of like, what feels right to me and what I want, but then the world is difficult, right? So then the reality is set in that, damn, what I want and what feels good, it's hard and I have to face fears, right? So how do you navigate that? Because so many people, I think, then they start to question, maybe this isn't what I want because it's so hard. Maybe it's not what I want because if I'm this fearful, it can't be good.
Yeah, the art world's a tough market to be in. I've watched a lot of people just give up. And sometimes people give up right before something really great's about to happen to them. And I've seen artists do that. I've seen galleries go in and out of business. And for me, it was on the business side, I'd rather be running my own shop and barely making any money, but, you know, running the ship versus working for someone else and not making any money. So I knew that. And I knew from just reading about other successful people and reading business books, and I love biographies and memoirs, and I love life stories and people's stories. And when I meet people, I love to get to know them on a deep level. So I knew that building a business was not going to be easy and that I would have to sacrifice a lot. So I kind of had that knowledge going in.
So you never thought that because it feels right, it should be, because this is the thing that I think I'm a little obsessed with, but it feels good. It's a passion. And so it should be easy. It's like sitting on a beach with a Mai Tai. And I feel that there's so many horrible messages out there telling you that passion equals ease. And there's an ease in life. Like life flows. Like there's a way in which things, when you're working hard, you don't feel like you're literally swimming in against the grain. But it's not easy like a beach day.
Yeah. No, I mean, and God, what just popped into my head was I love running. And I remember running the Boston Marathon. And I remember like feeling the love of running and feeling like my body moving. And I'm going up like this hill at mile 20. And I'm like, oh, God, this feels good. But this is so freaking hard.
Right. And
so.
Right. That contradiction.
I'm obsessed with the finish line. I'm obsessed with like being my best. And I know when I'm in these situations that I'm being challenged, but I love it. I get to show up and be my best, and I get to be, you know, an athlete and a curator and all these different things. And I want to create that. And it's not that I don't want ease. And I have lots of moments in my career where it, you know, magical and it feels amazing and easy. And, you know, sometimes with projects and clients, it's amazing. And then other times it's very challenging, but that to me is life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that is so poignant for me is you're running the marathon and your legs are burning and you're in that 20th mile, but you're happy to be there versus when we're doing things that we're working really hard at and we don't enjoy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's the difference. So I think either way you're working really hard, it's just, are you working really hard in the space that you love? And therefore, it kind of counterbalances that work. Because when you work really hard and it's just not your thing, I mean, you just want to quit. You're just like, I feel like 200 pounds, heavy, dread, right? Like all that stuff starts to kick in.
Oh, absolutely. And I've certainly worked in jobs before I opened my business where I knew like, okay, this is not working for me. This is not right. I it's not that I'm giving up. I just know I'm not supposed to be doing this. And I have friends that are in careers that they really don't want to be in. And they're burned out because they don't go to work with any excitement or passion. And it could be a company culture. It just could be that they're not in the they're working around people they don't like, or they're in an industry they don't like, and they have another true calling that they haven't gotten to. And I know that I've been able to create that. And that's where the authenticity comes in for me. I have been unwilling to settle into other careers, even though I might have started making more money way earlier than now. So worth the sacrifice to me. And a lot of artists do have to sacrifice, and some of them never make it and some of them do great. So everyone's different.
But I think this point of compromise, right? Because, you know, it'd be great if you could just do the art. I love, you know, writing and podcasting, but nobody pays for that. So you have to find a way to also subsidize what you're doing. And it's okay to have a little bit of a trade-off.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I feel that a lot of people have these inherent natural skills and talents, and that within a given industry, if you look within and you know what you love and what you're good at, part of it's being creative and finding your niche in the industry. And, you know, when I decided to open a gallery, it was by accident. I was kind of led right there. I was doing consulting. I was working in a gallery. They told me I couldn't do that unless I did it under their name. I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this under your name. And so it was kind of mutual. I quit. They fired me. And then I started consulting on my own. And I couldn't find another gallery that I actually wanted to work at selling the art that I wanted to be around and sell to people. And that's where the authenticity around starting my own business started kicking in for me, because a light bulb went off where I said, there are no galleries in this city that are showing the types of artists that I think should be shown. And so that's what I started working on. And that's how I opened my business, and that became my niche, and it kept expanding from there. But I think, you know, even as a writer, like I also do some business coaching, and I just helped an artist start a writing business. And she's a really good writer. She loves writing about art. And there are people out there that need to have people write about art that they hate writing about art. And she loves it. She's really good at it. So, you know, I would say, what do you love to do? What are you really good at? And how can you find a place in the marketplace to do that?
Oh my God. I mean, I just want to put a pin there, and I'm probably going to steal this piece of it and tweet it like crazy. But exactly, like, start with yourself and what is it that turns you on and excites you and what you're uniquely really good at, and then go find a place to put it. People spend all their time looking out at like different jobs and places and trying to fit into it, right? But it's so hard that way. You got to find out what you're uniquely good at, really discover your talents, what lights you up. And by the way, decade over decade, that can shift slightly, and that's okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
It should change. I think it should evolve as you evolve. Your personality and your knowledge base evolves. What you're doing typically would evolve with it. That's the other side of success. People are successful. They have enjoyed it, and they get stuck, and they're afraid to get out of something that they're successful with. And I've seen that in my industry.
Right. Because it's gotten easy. And you can just kind of go with it.
You can count on it. Yeah. And you're like, I like enough to keep doing it. But some people aren't even challenged by what they do anymore.
Uh-huh. No, I was there. I ran this healthcare company, and we set up this brand new innovative model, and it was great. But we were going to do the same model again for a different disease state. I'm like, I'm doing the same thing. Like, I did this, you know? And there was nothing, there was no challenge in it. And I just was like, right? But it's so hard to hop out because you've got so much expertise, and it's so easy, and I was getting paid so well. And it's like, I don't know, those competing value judgments, I think, that culture teaches us, you know, it's never enough, and just keep going, making a ton of cash. And
oh, it's true. Well, and I have multiple businesses and ideas going within my business that kind of cater to the different things that I love and can be challenged by. So I started an art consulting business maybe about 5 years ago. Part of it was because I wanted to see if, instead of, you know, working with clients, buying and selling one or two paintings, if I could work with people to curate bigger collections and, you know, place 200 pieces of art and not just one or two pieces, and be challenged with that level of art consulting. And so that was in response to me saying, you know, I'm really good at what I do. How can I challenge myself so it's more difficult and I'm more challenged by it?
Yeah. And that's where you grow and continue to learn.
Yeah.
I could talk to you all day. This is so much fun. Congratulations on your new book, The Art Cure, A Memoir of Abuse and Fortune. Anybody can pick it up now. It's available. Is it at Amazon? Where can they find this?
Yep, it's on Amazon.com. And I also have a website, BridgetMayer.com, that has more information about me personally. And then I have a gallery website, BridgetMayerGallery.com.
And as always, everything will be posted on my website, LauraCo.com. Podcasts, you can find Bridget and links to all of her information and her amazing new book. I gotta say, I don't usually say this. I'm gonna definitely check out your book. I just am blown away by your story. Congratulations with all your success, and thank you so much for coming on today's show.
Thank you so much, Laura. It was a pleasure. Great conversation.